and was David. He had some soldiers who were intensely faithful and loyal to him. Unfortunately, he was not always as loyal to them. In fact, while some of his soldiers were out at battle, he actually took one of their wives. Bathsheba was the wife of Uriah, and he had an adulterous affair with her. She became pregnant, and he did an abominable thing. He ordered through his general's king's authority that his loyal soldier, Uriah, be sent to the front lines to die because he wanted to cover up his own sin. The story is retold by our drama team. The theme is faithfulness, and the title for this morning's drama is A Tale of Two Soldiers.
Sound of 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
There.
Huh? David.
Well, Uriah, the battle is finally over, and we won. But, boy, I wish General David would have been here.
Well, if the general's not here, I'm sure he has good reason. Beth!
David. I'm pregnant.
I need to report to General David. I'll return later.
Yes, sir.
Beth!
David.
Uriah! I thought General David told you to go home to be with your wife. What are you doing here?
Home? How can I go home when my men are out in the field? If the ground is good enough for them, it's good enough for me. Bad.
David.
Uriah. How dry I am. Oh, dry
eye. Uriah.
Yeah.
I thought you were at dinner with General David.
Yeah.
Uriah, shouldn't you be home with Beth?
Home? Beth? How can I go home when my men are out fighting their hearts out? I gave my solemn vow to the general that I'd serve him all the days of fighting the war. I'll go home tomorrow.
David?
Bad. Soldier, deliver these battle plans. They're made expressly for me, my personal care from the general, and we don't want to disappoint the general.
Certainly, sir. By the way, it's good to have you back out here.
Thank you. Tell me, was it rough up there?
Sir, it's really getting tough out there.
Well, that's the life of a soldier, ready to die at any moment. But we're willing to sacrifice for our general and our country.
David.
Beth. Uriah.
Millions of people are at risk this morning across Latin America because of the threat of that devastating epidemic of cholera. Cholera is a frightening disease, a disease which causes such severe diarrhea that it is possible, in the case of young children, for example, to become dehydrated and to die within hours. At the same time, on the other side of the world, in Bangladesh, there is another great tragedy that is unraveling, where a calamitous typhoon has taken the lives. Already it is estimated to be more than 125,000 people who have died. And yet it is said that there are millions more in Bangladesh who are also at risk, again, to cholera. In both places, if you have heard the news reports that have been forthcoming, you know that the greatest need is for one thing, and that is for water. Not because there hasn't been enough rainfall in Peru and other Latin American countries, and certainly not because there's any shortage of water in Bangladesh, where there has been such severe flooding. The problem is that the water is not reliable, that the water supply is too often contaminated, and it is a primary channel for the spreading of disease. So people in these countries don't know whether the water they drink will save their lives or take their lives, and there's no way for them easily to determine it. Years ago, I was traveling in Africa and learned a lesson of a lifetime, and somewhere along the way, drinking impure water and becoming sick far away from home for 19 consecutive days, learning a lesson that ever since then, when traveling in third world countries, I'm always careful to make sure that the water is boiled or otherwise purified, and very careful on eating any fresh vegetables or fruit or anything like that. Because you can never know. It's just not the same as here in the United States, where you can go up to a drinking fountain anywhere in the country and not even give it a thought. You can drink out of a hose in somebody's backyard who's a complete stranger and be assured that the water is reliable, that it's trustworthy, that it's okay. What's interesting is how unimportant to us is that which is all important to these people in these troubled places. My guess is that probably not a single one of us this morning, when we got up and showered and shaved and made coffee and otherwise used the water that so freely comes from the faucets of our home, gave even a single thought about its purity, much less that it might be life-threatening. We thought maybe a little bit about the rain outside and wondered if it's going to keep raining, or we wondered what our schedule is going to be this afternoon, or worried a little bit about the car or what's on the docket for next week at work, but not a thought about getting cholera, of all things, from the city water supply. And that's because we assume that our water is trustworthy. I doubt that many of us would think of this water that flows so freely from our taps as a flavor. I mean, who would ever think of water as a flavor? If anything, we'd probably usually say it doesn't even have a taste to it. I mean, that's not what water is. It's just something that's there. And well, let me make a comparison for you this morning. Let me suggest to you that like water in our lives, especially in the critical places and the unusual times, is that flavor in the mixture of the fruit of the Spirit about which the Bible talks, of faithfulness. We're told that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Faithfulness is trustworthiness. Really, the two are the same thing. It's a common part of our vocabulary. We would say that a faithful friend is a friend that you can always trust. We might say that if you have a faithful dog, even if everybody else treats you rotten, you can depend upon your dog, who isn't all that smart, to like you. And if you have a faithful husband or a faithful wife, then you assume that that person will keep those vows recent or long ago, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. Or we have an expression in our society about someone who keeps the faith. That's not really a religious expression. It doesn't refer to religious faith. It's someone who is predictable, somebody who is dependable, someone who is reliable. Now, remember once before in conversation, we talked about how it's the fruit of the Spirit the Bible talks about, not the fruits, that it's singular. It's kind of like a recipe. There are these 9 different flavors that mix together and uniquely make, when the recipe is combined, that which is called the fruit of the Spirit. Now, I've got to be very careful here talking about recipes and things like that, because a cook I'm not. I mean, I have cooked a few things, but I have trouble with microwaves. They're just difficult for me to use, and that's about as sophisticated as I've gotten. But I have actually, along the way, baked a few cakes. Now, what I try to do is follow the recipe Is it called a recipe if it's on the back of a box? I'm not sure exactly what the correct terminology is here, but I have an idea of what the basic ingredients are. The stuff that's in the box is one of them. And then sometimes you put in eggs. I mean, I know. You take the shells off before you do it. I'm not totally ignorant on this. And then you throw in one or two or whatever the number of cups full of water. Now, imagine what would happen if you tried to put all that together, all the ingredients from the box or the recipe, and skip the water. I mean, it wouldn't stick together. You put it in the pan and you put it in the oven and you take the right temperature for the right period of time, and I don't know what you'd have. It would be some sort of a colossal gooey or stiff mess, but it wouldn't be the cake or anything like that which is pictured on the box on the outside. Although hardly do we think of the water as an ingredient, as a flavor, as something really that's all that important. And yet without it, all of the other ingredients, all of the other parts will fall apart. It's the water that makes the mix work. Now also, suppose that you could take the eight flavors or ingredients of the fruit of the Spirit and you could put them all together in somebody's life, but you left out faithfulness. Hey, the rest wouldn't work. They wouldn't stick together. Because if there wasn't a consistency, a reliability, a trustworthiness, and what would you have? You would have patience that sometimes loses its temper. Or you would have goodness that occasionally is evil. Or self-control that's out of self-control. Or gentleness that is mean. I mean, it simply wouldn't make any sense. And so trustworthiness is the glue that holds together all of the other Christian virtues. And faithfulness is trustworthiness. It can be demonstrated, I suppose, in scores of different ways. Faithfulness is keeping one's word. So if she's a Christian and she says, I'll do it, she'll do it. I mean, it's as good as done. Because that's what a faithful person is, someone who keeps her word. Faithfulness is paying one's bills. When I was a graduate student, I worked for a short time at the Cherry Creek store outside of Denver for Sears Roebuck Company and worked in the credit department. And in those days, it was a long time ago. It wasn't before computers, but it was before Sears had computers. And it was a manual system, and there were cards, like 4x6 cards, and on the front was all the typical credit application information, a name and address and telephone number and employer and income and those credit references and things like that. And then in the back of the card was a place where the employees could log things in, a date and the name of the person who had logged it in and various reference information or other dealings with that customer. It was my first day as an employee there that I read some of those cards as part of what I was doing in filing. And I remember seeing a number of them that had a date and AA. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's like a, I don't know, like a bond rating or like a grade that a teacher gives in school. I figured an A was good. I mean, an AA, that was really good. And I kept looking to see if there were any triple A's or quadruple A's or, until my trainer explained to me that it wasn't a rating at all. It was an abbreviation for as agreed. That here was a credit customer who paid as agreed. It wasn't saying that he didn't charge anything. It wasn't saying that he didn't owe anything, but he did what he signed a contract to do. He paid as agreed. Well, that's what faithfulness is. It's paying one's bills as agreed. Faithfulness is its dependability. There are very few surprises with a faithful person. She's the one that always does the job. He's the guy who, if he calls in sick, it's because he's sick. He's not trying to rip off the company. He's not trying to get away with something. He doesn't call in sick unless he is sick. Work is done on a consistent basis. That's what faithfulness is. Faithfulness includes loyalty. In fact, the Greek word, New Testament was written in Greek, is pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S, and it's sometimes translated by people who are translating from Greek into English as loyalty. The loyalty of one friend to another. That's what faithfulness is all about. The loyalty of a husband or wife who speaks well of his or her spouse. The loyalty of a friend who does not gossip behind a friend's back. Or the loyal employee who does not cheat on the boss. Oh, I mean, these are just a few. There are all kinds of expressions. I guess too many to make a list. But it's something that can and should permeate every aspect of life. A wonderful and a beautiful and a very strong virtue that gives credibility and strength to all of the other virtues of what life, and particularly the Christian life, is all about. And yet, you know, it is especially noticed when it's absent. Two friends of mine during the Vietnam War were even better friends with each other. They had, I think, known each other all of their lives. They had grown up together. The one was married, the other was single. It was the married guy who was drafted and who was sent to Southeast Asia. And he was concerned about his wife's welfare in his absence. His friend gave an assurance that if she faced some crisis, if she became sick or if she needed help or money, that he would be there. He would be a friend and he would take care of if that became necessary. The guy who went off to Vietnam was worried, but he took great comfort in knowing that he could count on his friend back home. What happened, I find personally still painful to think about, to tell now all these years later. Because the friend at home was not faithful. He had an affair with her. It ended their marriage. He was not trustworthy. Have you ever looked at a piece of dehydrated fruit? That which once was full and plump and all that it's supposed to be. You know, dehydration is technically the removal of water. So you could sort of say that all of the other ingredients are still there. It sure doesn't look the same. It doesn't smell the same. It doesn't taste the same. It is not the same. It's completely different when the water is taken out of it. And so it is with the dehydrated fruit of the Spirit. If faithfulness and trustworthiness are not there, I suppose theoretically you could say, well, kindness is, and there's patience, and there's love, and there's gentleness, and there's goodness. Maybe there still is, but it sure doesn't look the same or smell the same or taste the same because it's not the same if faithfulness is missing. Now, if you're like me, you hear all of this and you say to yourself, that's the way I want to be. I want to be faithful. I want to be the kind of person who's trustworthy and reliable. I want that to be me, but how do you grow that way? How do you become like that? Remember a moment ago, I mentioned that the Greek word is pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S. Well, usually there's one Greek word and it takes about 10 English words to define it. This is one of those rare occasions where it's kind of the other way around. For one Greek word has two different English means. You'd think there would be two different Greek words for them. For both faith and faithfulness are communicated by this single Greek term, epistis. We need to understand that there's a correlation between the two. In 1 Corinthians 1:9 in the New Testament, we are told that God is faithful to us, and that's why we have faith in him. So God's that way to us, and we have faith. We believe in him, which is to say that God is trustworthy. He's 100% that way. He keeps his word. He tells the truth. If he makes a contract down to the fine print, he keeps all the terms of what he says. I understand what faithfulness is by looking at God. I don't figure out, hey, this is the way I'm going to be trustworthy to people in my family or neighborhood or church or job or wherever, and that's what it's all about. Instead, I look to God and I see the way God relates to me and the way he treats me, and that's the way I'm supposed to treat other people. So I say that as a Christian, I have faith in God, and my faith in God then translates through me so that I can be faithful to other people. In fact, I suppose you could say that the simplest definition of what a Christian is somebody that has faith in this trustworthiness of God. That's where our confidence is. I think some people don't properly understand that. Some people think, oh, a Christian is somebody who goes to church or is baptized, or a Christian is somebody who keeps all the rules. It's interesting. The New Testament says it's not by keeping the rules. In fact, if you don't keep the law because you can't keep the law. It doesn't make any difference one way or the other. That what really makes a Christian is to have faith in Jesus Christ. A Christian is someone who believes what God says, that we're sinners, that he loves us, that Jesus Christ came and died on the cross so that we don't have to be sinners anymore and we can have eternal life. So a Christian is someone who believes God and believes God is trustworthy. And when we do, then an extraordinary thing happens. As we have that kind of faith in God, we then grow in our faithfulness of relationships to other people. The two are connected. You ever pick up these newspaper or magazine articles that are promoting the sale of government securities, sometimes through mutual funds or brokerage houses or bond houses? And there's a line that sometimes is in rather large print, sometimes it's in the fine print at the bottom, but it's often there that says, these securities are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. That's saying that if you buy them, you have something that is guaranteed. Because the United States government is the longest continuous democracy in history. It is an extremely stable government. It pays its bills. It's reliable. I mean, in comparison to all the 200-some countries in the world, there really hardly is any comparison. And so if the full faith of the United States government, the credit of the United States government is behind something, then it's very, very strong. As strong almost as the money itself. And if the government fails, then probably hardly anything is of value in terms of money or investment. Now, when an investor puts his or her money with a faithful government, then that investor can be trusted by other people to be financially secure. Or let me pull you into this with you're involved in a deal. Let's suppose you're going to sell a house, pick a round figure and say it's for $100,000. And you have two prospective buyers, both of whom give you an offer for the asking price, $100,000. And you decide that you're going to do some checking to find out whether either of these buyers really has the money. And you discover that buyer number one has $100,000 in Iraqi oil bonds. And the other one has $100,000 in U.S. government bonds that mature this Friday. Now, which one are you going to sell your house to? Obviously, you're going to sell your house to the one who has put his or her faith in the right place, aren't you? Because that's going to make a difference to you on whether that person can perform. The Christian who has faith and confidence in a trustworthy God is the Christian who can be faithful in relationships with other people. Again, the two are connected. The one links in with the other. Faith grows faithfulness. The way to become a faithful person is not so much to say, I'm going to become trustworthy starting tomorrow morning. It's far better to say, I'm going to trust God. And as I place my faith in him and understand what faithfulness is all about, then I am going to demonstrate that in relationship with other people. It means that if we want our lives to be flavored with faithfulness and trustfulness, then we should start out by placing our own faith and trust in a trustworthy God. Now, it's a very attractive virtue. You know, as an employer, I want to hire faithful employees. As a husband, I highly value a faithful wife. As a person, I value faithful friends. That's the kind of friends that I want to have. And as a Christian, that's the kind of person I want to be. Faithful, because I know that's attractive. Not to me, but to God. There's a wonderful example of attractiveness. You can look it up for yourself or just listen for a moment. It's on page 1858 of the Pew Bible if you want to read it. But it's set in the first century context of slavery in the Roman Empire. There are some people who say that they think there's a pretty good case that there were more slaves in the Roman Empire than there were people who were free, maybe significantly more. Slavery is inexcusable. It's morally destitute. It is an abomination that one person should own another person. It's inhuman, it's inhumane, it's tragic. But it was a great reality in that first century Roman Empire when Christianity came. There were slaveholders who became Christians, who set their slaves free. A lot of people didn't understand that. That's because their own lives have been transformed. But what happened to those slaves who became Christians, who had owners who didn't like that? Owners who had no time for God or Jesus Christ or Christian teaching at all. The New Testament, under those oppressive circumstances, gives this advice in Titus 2, 9, and 10, saying, teach slaves to be subject to their masters in everything, to try to please them, not to talk back to them, and not to steal from them, but to show them they can be fully trusted. Show them that they can be fully trusted, so that in every way they will make the teaching about God, our Savior, attractive. How did slaveholders become Christians? By Christian slaves attracting them to God through trustworthiness in the worst of circumstances. And how then can Christians attract people to God today? At least one of the key means is through faithfulness, trustworthiness, dependability. It was a powerful practice and virtue then, and is a powerful practice and virtue today. When we want to impact our families and friends and our whole world around us, even under the worst of circumstances. This past week, a Wooddaler sent to me a sheet of paper telling me all about geese. I mean, something I was really hoping would happen last week. And it explained a lot of things, a lot more than I really wanted to know. It explained, for example, why geese fly in a V formation. And it got rather technical at times about how the flapping of their wings makes an uplift that then helps the birds behind fly. And, I mean, some scientists with too much time in his hands figured out that a bird, a goose, can get to its destination 71% faster as a result of this, because, you know, the guy in front's flapping his wings. And explains that a goose that falls out somehow quickly figures that out and is going to be late for, I don't know, an appointment in Florida or something. And so he quickly gets back in. And then it talked about the bird that's in front, and when that bird gets tired, it rotates out. And then another bird comes in, and it explained why the ones in the back honk. I mean, I was really hoping to figure that out this past week. It's encouragement to the ones up front. You know, I mean, when you're driving down 35W and the people behind you honk, it was trying to encourage you. You know, you know why they do that. Anyway, so it's telling all this stuff. But one of the things it explained was that when one of the geese in this V formation gets sick, or one of you hunters shoots it, and it goes down, that two other geese pull out of the formation and go down with it and stay by that wounded bird until it either dies or it's able to make it on its own before they resume their journey. Now, it seems to me that they're faithful. They're trustworthy geese. The question is, how did they get that way? My conclusion is that God created them that way. I mean, God made them to be like that. The same God who created us in His image and who created us to be flavored with the fruit of the Spirit in the image of a faithful God. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness.
Jerry Barnaby comes to share with us in our faith story segment. He's introduced to us in our bulletin. We welcome to our pulpit, Jerry. Thank you.
Do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter under consideration shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? As a trial attorney, I've heard these or very similar words countless times, and yet you don't need a law degree to recognize this familiar legal phrase. Whether from Perry Mason or L.A. Law or personal experience, we all know these words, and we know they're accompanied by raising your right hand. We know that this is an oath that a person takes when he is going to serve as a witness in court. It sets the standard for the story he is going to tell. As a Christian, I believe these words also set the standard for us who serve as witnesses to Jesus Christ. We are to tell the truth about what God, through his Son, has done in our lives. The whole of our lives should express this truth, and we should live so that nothing but this truth is heard. This morning, I feel privileged to testify of Jesus Christ in my life, and I almost forgot. I do. I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't know that God loved me or that Jesus died for my sins. As a young child growing up in the church, I knew these things and believed them to be true. In fact, I knew a lot about God, or at least enough to win a model airplane in a first grade Sunday school competition. And that's how I proceeded through the first 15 years of my life, knowing a lot about God. It wasn't until the summer before my sophomore year in high school that I started questioning whether knowing about God was enough. The source of this questioning was my mother. My parents were divorced when I was in junior high. In the aftermath of the divorce, I saw my mother searching for love, peace, and security in many different places. Ultimately, because a neighbor was willing to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, Mom became a Christian. Mom's transformation was both amazing and a little bit annoying. I saw that she was a happier, more peaceful person, but I also knew that now we would have to put up with reading the Bible every night after dinner. In August 1976, using a less than subtle evangelism technique, Mom demanded that my two sisters, my brother, and I attend a local crusade. That night, the four of us knelt with Mom and asked Jesus to take his rightful place as Lord and Savior in our lives. For me, the night challenged me to move beyond what my mind knew about God to what my spirit demanded, actually knowing God. My Christian walk was encouraged early on through my family, Christian classmates, and involvement in a local Christian singing group. In college and in law school, I was involved in the campus ministry of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and there received quality training in the areas of discipleship, evangelism, and missions. Today, I'm blessed with an abundance of opportunities for ministry and for telling the truth. Here at Wooddale, I'm involved with a leadership team that is dedicated to telling the truth in the Single Life Fellowship. More recently, I become involved in telling the truth in creative and challenging ways through the drama ministry. My work situation is unique in that nearly all the attorneys in my firm are Christians. As a result, discussions about faith and church are not unusual. Clients may ask for advice on issues such as should Christians sue one another, and I have opportunities, often daily, to tell the truth to the secretaries and legal assistants. My prayer is that through my words, actions, and lifestyle, they will experience the whole truth and nothing but the truth. A witness tells what he or she knows to be true. In court, we don't let witnesses speculate about what may be true, and we keep them from telling what has been told to them as hearsay. We want witnesses to speak from their own experience and their own knowledge. That guarantees the most reliable testimony. As I consider our roles as witnesses for Christ, I'm convinced the same standard applies. Jesus calls us to stand as his witnesses in the world. He calls us to let our entire lives speak of what we know of him to be true from our own daily experience. In word and in deed, we must tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help us, God.